everybody. It is September 16th, 2021. This is your home away from homeroom, your daily homeroom, the ADK homeroom. And I am your host, teacher in exile, Frank. And we are here today with another great episode. We're going to talk about laser light today. We're going to talk about what high schoolers don't know. I've spent 25 years in the classroom, and again, it's not about blaming the kids for this. It's more of an indictment of our education system. And there is plenty that high schoolers today do know. High school has changed a lot over the last 50 years. So we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about that and see what we can see. We'll also have an E. Paul Torrance quiz on fluency today. You'll note that it is a bit of a change up to the format again, trying to do a deep dive into a single topic. But don't worry, the news roundup will be back again tomorrow, and we'll dig into all kinds of interesting topics like the Boston professor at the School of Public Health at Boston University who fell through a stairway and unfortunately died as the result. Reminds me a little bit of a David Morelli book. But we'll investigate that tomorrow. We'll look at all kinds of interesting things there tomorrow. Let's get into it today. Science fact of the day. I drove my car into a fact, and I don't care. I love it. We got two parts today for the science fact of the day. They're both about light. First, I've often received the question, how is laser light different from normal light? Well, there are three main qualities of laser light. First, it is monochromatic. What does monochromatic? Mono means one, chromatic means color, of course. So that's a single wavelength, a single color. Your brain, your consciousness, interprets wavelengths as a color. If you could see radio wavelengths of light, of the electromagnetic spectrum, you could look at a radio tower, and the radio tower would look really, really bright in a color that only H.P. Lovecraft could describe, because we're not used to seeing colors outside of about 450 to 700 nanometers. 700 nanometers, your brain interprets as red. 470 nanometers, 500 nanometers, your brain interprets as deep blue. That's just how it works. That's why sometimes you can see books like The Blueness of Blue, talking about our conscious experiences. So that's laser light. It's a single color. But if you think about it, right, if I take a flashlight and I put a red filter over it, that's only red light coming out of the flashlight. That's only one color. So that doesn't make the flashlight into a laser light. So there's got to be something else going on there too. Even better, if I take like a neon sign or fluorescent light bulb that only emits certain specific wavelengths to begin with, and then I just look at one of those wavelengths or I put a filter on those, then I really have just a single wavelength of electromagnetic radiation coming out from that source, but it's still not a laser. So there must be more to laser light than just monochromatic. And there are. There are two other properties we didn't get to. So single wavelength, single color, monochromatic, that's the first property of laser light to pay attention to. Second, it's directional, right? You have an incandescent bulb or an LED bulb, and it shines isotropically. A star even shines isotropically. All directions at once, the light comes out. Lasers don't diverge like that. They stay tight. They are able to carry their intensity, because they don't diverge very much, to very distant points. They can bring intensity to very distant points. They don't disperse their energy. They don't become, they don't diverge as they travel or as they propagate. This is much, much, much harder to do with regular light, but still you can approximate this effect, right? In some crude sense with a bullseye lantern or maybe a flashlight with a mirror to reflect all the light in one direction. You get kind of a beam. But again, that still doesn't make your flashlight a laser. So we need to keep going here. The third property of laser light that is unique, Very unique. Now, I know, according to the old rules of grammar, a little bit of a theme here today with grammar, the old rules of grammar would say that you can't say very unique, but Steven Pinker, in a sense of style, changing that, says it's okay to say very with unique. Anyway, this last property of lasers, they're coherent, or the cat is meowing. Oh, this cat is driving me nuts. All right, so lasers are coherent. Put it another way, all of their light waves are in phase. They go up at the same time, down at the same time, if you want to think of it that way. The peaks line up, all the troughs line up, and that just does not happen with normal light. Normal light is an all out of phase. One of the waves coming out of the source will be oscillating up and down at the same wavelength, the same frequency as all the other ones, but it will start before it or start after it so that their peaks don't all line up. So those three things make a laser: same wavelength, same direction, same phase. And that phase is a tricky one. Try to picture all the different waves coming out of there, waving up and waving down at the same time. So if you superimpose their graphs on top of each other, they reinforce, they make a dense pattern, and the troughs and the peaks all line up instead of scrambling together to make a blur. I promise you two things about light. The second thing I want to just mention about light today and the science fact today is that light bounces and light worms its way through tiny, very tiny gaps. No less a luminary than Andy Weir sort of skipped over this fact in Project Hail Mary. Love Project Hail Mary. Do you guys read Project Hail Mary? It's hard to talk about it without spoiling it, so I don't want to, but this is the guy who wrote The Martian, if you saw the movie The Martian, and the book is, of course, excellent. Well, Martian was a good book. This is a great book. Project Hail Mary. Got to go read it. Andy Weir. And at one point, our hero is dealing with an organism, and he's trying to prevent light from getting in there, so to his testing area. So he just whips out some duct tape and wraps it around this sensor or this chamber that he's trying to protect from light. I gotta say no. Puts a blanket over it, duct tape over it. That is not gonna do it. Anybody who's ever tried to keep light out, not gonna do it, right? I work with scintillators, with scintillating plates, with photomultiplier tubes, and it takes work to keep those out of there. Maybe not as much work as keeping this cat out of my studio or chasing my toddler around all day. Oh my gosh. But we would get out Tyvek, we'd get out electrical tape, and we would go to town on that thing. And even then you would still get counts coming through. And it's hard to keep light out of something. It is really good at sneaking through. We had so much Tyvek on there, but Project Hail Mary is still a great book. Just wanted to point out, though, that part is not quite as hard science as some other parts in there. Excellent book, though. Go read it. Very, very, one of the best books that I've read in recent years, without a doubt. Let's go into today's topic. We've got the top 8 things that American high schoolers don't know. They do know a lot, and in many ways, high school has improved over the last 50 years. But there are certainly some gaps, and there's some ways that high school has not improved. So I'm not trying to pile on the students. Love my students. Love teaching. But there are some areas here that sometimes make my jaw just smash down onto the lab table, because what the heck is going on here? Let's start. Number 8 here. This one just came up for the very first time starting maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I started to notice my students did not know who Mark Twain is. As in, no clue. They have heard, interestingly enough, of Tom Sawyer. I don't know if it's the Rush song. I'm not sure, but maybe it's the old Goosebumps. But Mark Twain, no. I happened to be talking one day about how his short stories involved uranium, or at the end, his Sold to Satan story was involving uranium. And the kids said, or radium, excuse me, and they said, "Radium, that's Marie Curie." "Yes, good, I'm glad you know that." And then they said, "But Mark Twain?" And I said, "Yeah." And then we had to go over who Mark Twain is. Now, can you think of a reason that Mark Twain might not be known? Last year, my 10th graders, literally none of my 10th graders knew Mark. Well, actually, one, I think. There was one guy who was absent, and then he came in and he sort of saved the median knowledge marker there. He knew Mark Twain when he came in. Maybe he'd heard that I was going to ask that question. I don't know. I don't know. But it's pretty clear to me, I think, the English teachers are afraid to teach him. History teachers are afraid to touch him because he breaks the taboo, right? He uses racial slurs that some people treat like Voldemort's name. You just can't say them. Teachers are terrified to deal with it. He has some issues in some of his books that people, they're the third rail, right? In education, nobody wants to go there. So that's the situation. Sometimes I wonder if Mark Twain would be pleased or upset with his continuing iconoclastic status, or maybe he'd be pleased and upset at the same time. A little self-satisfaction, and he'd berate us all for fools. Who knows? But yeah, very possibly both. By the way, Mark Twain did have a camp right up near here in the heart of the Adirondacks. Sometimes it's hard to see how he could be so down on life at the end of life, in such a great spot over there, overlooking the mountain lake, loons calling all the time over there. It's like a chickadee swarm over there. I have to tell you, those chickadees, they do that that single note call over there all the time. I think it's just the male chickadees who do that. And you've got martins loping along the shore over there. So whenever I'm paddling by there, I always think, "Cheer up, Mark." But he didn't. But hey, at least he got to see Halley's Comet in the last year of his life. So he's got that going for him. And that's it. That's number eight. 10th graders last year, oof, they all knew Fidel Castro, but had not heard, with maybe that one exception, of Mark Twain. Number seven on our list today, how to build and fix crap. Everything, building and fixing, home improvement, home repairs, cars. No, they don't know. They don't know this. There have been a lot of memes going around on social media extolling the virtue of the trades, right? You see Mark Rowe, excuse me, Mike Rowe, memes out there saying we have to put vocational schools on the same footing as colleges. And these are good memes. I subscribe to these memes and I put my official ADK homeroom stamp of approval on these memes. I need to get that. I think you can order those, can't you? Like those little rubber stampers. I need to get an ADK homeroom stamp of approval. All right, I'll look at that. That'll beat my Mandalorian sticker book that I've just been stickering on everything when I like it. Yes. Try sending your kids into school one day with Mandalorian stickers on their forehead. Yeah, it's fun. All right, so let's look here at we're on number seven, and we're facing a problem here. Let's look. The CPWR, Center for Construction Research and Training, between 1985 and 2015, the average age of all U.S. workers increased by 4.9 years because we are aging as a population, but construction workers jumped over 6.5 years. Roughly the same time span, 1985 to 2012, the average age of a construction worker was in 1985, 1.5 years below the average age of the worker in all industries averaged together. Then in 2012, the construction worker's average age had caught up and was passing the other industry average. And now, here in 2019, most recent data, construction workers are a year older on average. So not only is the American workforce aging, but construction workers in particular are aging at a more rapid pace, so that where they used to be younger, now the average construction worker is older than the average worker as a whole. We are just not getting enough people into the construction trades, the building trades, the trades in general. Most of my fellow homeowners here in the ADKs will vouch for that, trying to find somebody who can help, because I am like the world's least handy physics teacher, right? I can do some basic stuff, but I am not going to be out there building my own addition to my house and putting in the plumbing, putting in the wiring. That's beyond me. So trying to find somebody who can do that, it's just really hard. So anecdotally, as well as with this data here from CPWR, construction trades, building trades, it's hurting, right? And when I look in school, we have our local vocational school or trade school. People in New York, they call it BOCES. It stands for Board of Cooperative Educational Services, in several different districts around the area get together, and they have their own auto shop there. They have their own wood shop, metal shop, things like that. But nowadays, when I talk to the kids from our school who head over to BOCES, I would say auto shop and wood shop are in the minority of classes that they take. Things where you build, things where you have your hands on what we would consider construction items or building items, they are the minority. I hear mostly people go over there and they do culinary arts, right? Or they do video gaming. We have a big BOCES program on learn to code your video games. Now, computer coding is great, and it is a form of building, but still, it is on the list of things that high schoolers don't know how to build and fix crap. Also, of course, cosmetology is big at BOCES, and I don't think that BOCES does CNC at all, computer numerical code, right? This programming for the big giant machines on the factory floors. I would love to see them put that in there. So that's number 7, is building and fixing. Number 6 on the list of things high schoolers don't know, capitalism. This is not a surprise, of course, given the state of our current educational system. And to be honest, most adults don't know capitalism either. I ask kids these days what capitalism is. Most common answer I get is it's what we have. It's our system. And a lot of kids, they will say markets. Now, that's not the worst answer. The worst answers would probably be, which I do get. I get things like, a lot of times people say, oh, capitalism, that's when the workers are exploited. Or capitalism, that's when there are no regulations to stop companies from doing whatever they want. Sometimes people will say capitalists are the rich people. That's what it means to be a capitalist, to be rich. And a lot of teachers I would include in not knowing this too. For years, our government teacher did this project, and the kids were putting up posters outside the room, one country per poster. And one of the little boxes they had to fill in on the poster for their country that they were doing was economy. And every country except China, North Korea, and Cuba got capitalist, which is ironic, right? Because China's economy, not necessarily their political landscape, but their economy has been one of the more capitalist, maybe up until the recent crackdown. Did you see? Not only are video games getting on the block, but cosmetic surgery probably the next to come up. FT.com, Financial Times, great article on that the other day. So I would see posters outside this guy, like Afghanistan was listed as capitalist, Ethiopia listed as capitalist, Russia listed as capitalist. I think the kids are being taught that as long as there's a market, it's capitalist. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a black market, doesn't matter if women aren't allowed in the market, that they're missing that keyword free in free market. As long as there's a market, it's capitalist. Doesn't matter how controlled the market is, doesn't matter if there are price controls, none of that matters. Unless it has a government standing up, their own government standing up and saying explicitly, we're communist, like, you know, China or Pyongyang there, then it got capitalist. I suppose that does make it easier for our government to constantly blame capitalism for the failures that we have here, even though we have at least a 50% socialist market these days. Number five on our list. You know what? Let's do our fluency quiz today. Let's jump to the fluency quiz. All right. E. Paul Torrance had a lot of hallmarkers, a lot of hallmarks of creativity. One of them was, of course, fluency. Did a flexibility quiz the other day this week where you had to think of multiple uses for the same idea. Fluency is thinking of multiple topics within the same category or multiple examples of the same idea. So today we're going to go with an idea or a word that is near and dear to my thought. The Wolverines. That's right, my beloved Wolverines of University of Michigan. Big game coming up this weekend against the Huskies of Northern Illinois. So Wolverines, we're going to do this here today. Number one, Logan. Marvel's Wolverine. That's right, old man Logan. Great, great, great. If you really want to see the start, well, not the start, but growing up of comics as literature, look at Frank Miller's Marvel limited series for Wolverine 1 through 4 from about 1983. Number two, winged helmet. Yes, I just talked about it at University of Michigan Wolverines. Now here's a harder one. Trickster. Trickster within the category Wolverines. Would it help if I said Quackashoo? Probably not. It turns out it's very interesting that among the Algonquin, the Wolverine was the trickster god who created the world. He even had a Noah's Ark device, the Wolverine did, and he commanded the mink to go out and get things and fix the ark, and he made the world. And he was also a trickster god, kind of like Loki. So he's a combination of Loki and the creator gods. Very interesting. And also in Northwest Canada, among some other native peoples in Northwest Canada, the Wolverine was also the trickster god. Widely separated there. Interesting. I don't know if they had some sort of Celtic migration similar to the Celtic migration in Europe going on. I don't know. But trickster god, the Wolverine in both places. Next one. This is number four. Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey. Perhaps another hard one. Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey. Yes, they were both in Red Dawn together, and they were both the Wolverines in Red Dawn. Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey. It's true, we're in a movie together before Dirty Dancing. Not as good as Dirty Dancing, but let's face it, that's a high bar. Red Dawn's still pretty good. Next, number five, footwear. Okay, sure, Wolverines is a brand of footwear. Next one, number six, this could be a hard one again. George Armstrong Custer. Yeah, how does that fit into the Wolverines category? George Armstrong Custer, it turns out he actually led the brigade known as the Wolverines, the Michigan Brigade, at Gettysburg. And he was more successful there, of course, than he was at Little Bighorn. So that is your fluency quiz going over Wolverines there. And I think, E. Paul Torrance, I have great respect for him. I think that his exercises there really do help you be more creative. Help you stretch your mind, at least in the directions of creativity and production, too, really. It helps your productivity to really have things at the tip of your tongue and be able to quickly get things out. Helps you be efficient, helps you be prolific. Number five here on our things list of things high schoolers don't know. This is a combination insurance, finance, investing, handling money in general. This is probably the number one question I get from high schoolers all the time. How do I do money? What is this? What is a mortgage? What is insurance? A lot of times the high schoolers these days, they think of insurance as some sort of combination of a license or a pass or a service fund. I'll be talking with a student about car insurance and she'll say, "Oh yeah, yeah, well, I have to have my car insurance, got to get my license, got to pass a DMV test." Just checking off the boxes as just these are just the things you need to be able to drive. Health insurance, well, that's a pass. That's a pass to the doctor's office. And then you talk to a student and he'll say something like, It's ridiculous they don't give health insurance to everybody. Don't they want people to go to the doctor's office? Let people go. Give them the insurance. You have to be rude, racist, or sexist, or evil not to give everyone insurance so that they can get into the doctors. And then the students will say, some of the students, of course, there are always exceptions, they'll say, it needs to be any type of doctor. Why would you give them this insurance just for some types of doctors? They really don't have an idea of insurance as a hedge against disaster. That has faded, and I think we are the worse for it. Of course, in terms of investing, most students, they don't know what the index funds are, and they're encouraged to do this. Again, I'm not getting down on the students here. Students are just as talented as ever, but the educational system is failing them in a lot of respects, so they don't know these things. For example, the stock market game. This is a pretty popular game. A lot of schools across the country, especially here in New York, play the stock market game. And it's pretty much designed to teach kids the worst thing about investing and about the stock market. For example, it's a short term, very short term, like a few months long, because they do one a semester, including over the summer. And then the way you're put in this pool, which with a bunch of other people. And because of the nature of volatility and the nature of randomness, and the winner is the guy who comes out at the end, or the girl who comes out at the end with the highest value in their portfolio, right? So because you're just put into this group and everybody can go after it, it's likely that the winner just gets lucky. It's likely that the winner is just somebody who has put their funds into a couple single stocks and happens to have those stocks go up over the next couple of months. Of course, at least my investment advice for the kids, and I think a lot of people's investment advice, is you look at long-term investing. If you're not going to be like a day trader, if this couldn't be your job, if you're investing to build wealth for you and for your family, long-term investing, a lot of the stuff that's done in the stock market game is just the opposite. You don't want to be risky. The way to win the stock market game is just to take your risks, take big chances, and hope that things come through for you. They encourage you to invest all of your funds right at the start. So dollar cost averaging, this idea that you put a little bit of money in, you know, this week, then a little bit of money in next week, then a little bit of money in the week after that, to try to even out the highs and lows of the market when you're doing your buys, that idea has completely gone by the wayside in the stock market game. And of course, they don't talk about expense ratios. Expense ratios tend to show up more in the long term. They play a very muted role in the stock market game, if they play a role at all, and because sometimes the way that the investing done is a little bit unrealistic. And of course, in real life, expense ratios can eat up what you're doing. They're extremely important. So that's another way the stock market game just really sort of turns kids away from what I would consider safer, less risky, long-term investing, and encourages them to give their money to middlemen who are doing mutual funds, or to risk their money in a non-diverse portfolio. That's part of the short-term nature of it, and it's part of the risky or part of the pool nature of it. The winner is almost always somebody who just got lucky. I've helped kids set up a couple of IRAs while they're still in high school. Almost all boys, which is interesting to me, they're eager for this knowledge. They are dying to learn how to set up an IRA, how to invest, and they have no idea how to do it. But if you form a lunch group and you sit down and you say, all right, we're going to go to Vanguard's website, we're going to look at index funds, we're buying individual stocks, we're going to learn about ETFs, we're going to learn about the importance of expense ratios, they are there. They get their lunch, they come up to your room, they do that. And so it's not on kids here. This is an educational system. And of course, things like mortgages, no idea, loans, no idea in general about loans, probably setting kids up for taking whatever they get when they get to college loans. They have heard of interest rates, but that's about it. Next, Let's talk about resilience. This is number 4.5. We're throwing in a bonus one here. I guess it's the top nine things. Resilience in the face of adversity. Not all kids here. Some kids are extremely resilient, but they aren't learning that resilience at school. At school, these kids, they've never been cut from a team. Or in big schools, maybe they're cut from a team, but they still don't have to go a season without playing because they can just join a local league. They've never been left out of a school play. I've seen chorus teachers, they create 12 new parts in a play and wedge them in just to make sure that everybody gets to be in the play. They've never had, you know, the youth these days, they've never had their best friend die to consumption. Yeah, I just said consumption. Cue the Moulin Rouge soundtrack. They've never had, you know, their friend, they call him Flipper because he grew up with an arm stunted by polio. They've never even had anybody called Flipper or any other name. Kids are super nice these days, almost excruciatingly nice. There are exceptions. Soccer practice the other night, we had one little miscreant pull down the pants of some other kid. So that does still happen, but it's very, very rare. I was shocked. I hadn't seen anything like that happen in a long time. Very rare. So kids are so nice, and we're not talking like Straussian nice or like D.H. Lawrence English are so nice. We're talking like real, genuine nice. There aren't any John Hughes teenage movies anymore, right? Because kids learned his lessons so freaking well, and they taught them to other kids. The Buffy episode with the umbrella at the prom. People know these lessons. Now the teen movies are like Let It Snow or Fault in Our Stars, which is great, but that's, you know, that's a long way from Rebel Without a Cause or The Fault in Our Hubris or anything Greek. It's all Christian now, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We need to do an episode on that, by the way. Greeks versus Christian hero archetypes. Note to self. So the kids these days, yeah, definitely haven't seen anybody get kicked out of school, miss their opportunity to learn because we don't do that anymore. So yeah, kids just do not have a lot of experience with hardship. Next on our list, number 4, is art. Definitely art history, but not just art history. They don't know, for example, Mozart from Philip Glass. They do not know Titian from Kandinsky. They don't even know who these people are. They do know Mozart. They would recognize Mozart. But for the most part, art history has been lost to them. Now, it's not just art history, though. It's discussing art. The idea of symbols, the idea of motifs, the idea of subtext, themes, these are not present in the curriculum. Kids are not learning these things. For example, Buffy, perennially popular. Everybody knows Buffy. But nowadays, when people talk about Buffy, their analysis of the richest show ever to be on television, the most complex, the best show, in my opinion, ever to be on television, is Buffy. And the kids these days, when they talk about it, they are familiar with it, and they say, oh, yeah, well, the vampires represent sexual predators, the werewolves represent the physical abusers and toxic masculinity, that's how they see things. It is all about victimhood and oppression and identity politics. They don't look for symbols. They can't talk about sex outside of assault. They can't talk about violence outside of wrongdoing. They can't talk about stakes or the music or dualism. They can't see the role of family. I just mentioned Greek versus Christian hero archetype. That is certainly not anything that they're familiar with. So it's really rough when they try to analyze art. They really only have a couple of tools to analyze it with. And those tools, of course, again, are this sort of, you have been persecuted, look for the group that has been oppressed the most, look for this class warfare in your shows. A lot of Buffy as proletariat, right? In the first episode of season 3, she leads a workers' revolt against the demons. And that's how they see things. That is the extent of it. They can't go into anything beyond that. All right, let's go to our next topic here. Number 3 on the list, how to Mac. That's right. Teenagers these days, at least compared to teenagers a few decades ago, are far less randy. These numbers are straight from the CDC, so 38% in 2019, teenagers reporting had ever had sexual intercourse. In 1991, that was 55%. That is a pretty huge drop, 17%. So, this is interesting in light of Scott Aronson's famous comment 171. Scott Aronson, of course, is this brilliant, amazing computer science expert at MIT, but he also runs a really good blog, Shtetl Optimized. And one, probably his most famous blog post ever, had nothing to do with computer science or quantum computing or anything like that. It was about his own adolescence. And I'm just going to read it to you because it's so striking here. So this is one of the most brilliant people around here talking about his adolescence and his thoughts during that. I'll quote him here. Alas, as much as I try to understand other people's perspectives, the first reference to my male privilege, is approximately where I get off the train because it's so alien to my actual lived experience. Here's the thing. I spent my formative years basically from the age of 12 until my mid-20s, feeling not entitled, not privileged, but terrified. I was terrified that one of my female classmates would somehow find out that I sexually desired her, and that the instant she did, I would be scorned, laughed at, called a creep and a weirdo, maybe even expelled from school or sent to prison. And furthermore, that the people who did these things to me would somehow be morally right to do them, even if I couldn't understand how. You can call that my personal psychological problem if you want, but it was strongly reinforced by everything I picked up from my environment. To take one example, the sexual assault prevention workshops we had to attend regularly as undergrads, with their endless lists of all the forms of human interaction that might be sexual harassment or assault, and their refusal ever to specify anything that definitely wouldn't be sexual harassment or assault. I left each of those workshops with enough fresh paranoia and self-hatred to last me through another year. Wow. I mean, the first thing you think after hearing that is you're sorry for Scott. I wish Scott would have done what I did, which is walk out of those workshops, right? That's the best thing, and that's what I advise. Just leave. Just get the heck out of there. He wrote that in 2014, right? And it's just gotten worse now. Boys are terrified out there. Girls are frustrated and confused. A lot of these people, a lot of these kids out there, teenagers, they don't know how to get together. Or they do, but they don't know if it's worth the risk. They don't know if they are evil for knowing how to get together or wanting to get together or figuring out how. They're told it's evil. And it's hard for me, with my natural sort of maverick mindset, to understand how someone as brilliant as Scott could fall for this crap. But I think that leads into my next point. So number 2, things teenagers don't know who they are. Number 2 is who they are. Masculine identities in particular, but feminine identities too. You know, you had certain role models, stereotypes, icons, whatever you want to call them in the past. You had the grunge. I would see the students come through in the 90s with grunge. They were clearly trying to be a grunger. You had Valley Girls in the 80s, right? When I went to school, you could see which girls were trying to be Valley Girls. In the early 2000s, there was a significant population of kids who were clearly trying to be Pat Tillman, right? Remember Pat Tillman, great jockey and jock, and then he left the NFL to enlist really and join the special forces, went to Afghanistan. Unfortunately, he was killed, but there was a brief surge there where a lot of boys were clearly trying to be Pat Tillman. I remember a field trip to Arlington in Washington, D.C., and when we came back, there were boys, walking with military precision, and they were practicing their formation walks up and down the middle school hallways. You had country boys and girls as country music took over for pop music. Carrie Underwood just taking American Idol by storm. And now, not too many models like that. I do see some kids who are trying to be Taylor Swift, both boys and girls, but scientist, businessman, no, right? Bill Gates, he's either an evil capitalist pig if you're on the left, or he's microchipping your brain if you're on the right. Sports heroes, I don't see it so much, right? You look at Colin Kaepernick, if you're on the left, he's a tool of the bourgeoisie, or on the right, he's a fool for not being grateful for what he had. It's not easy to find role models these days. Pro wrestlers are laughed at. YouTube influencers are denigrated. Jordan Peterson, James Charles, forget about it. You're going to find people laughing at you no matter what your chosen model is. There used to be this all-American boy of daring, right? The Hardy Boys or the football hero in the post-war period. Even like I said earlier, John Hughes, the great unifier, he taught us that everybody's a basket case, an athlete, a princess, a criminal, a brain. But there's people have learned that lesson and they have moved beyond it, but now they don't have anything new. And teenagers, they do not know who they're supposed to be. And they're definitely aware of who people like Ibram Kendi and their guidance counselor are telling them they should be, and they're aware that that person is different from what centuries of history have told them to be, and they recognize that there is a disconnect there, and it's very, very hard for them to figure that out. Now, number one on the list of things teenagers don't know is, coming back to earth a little bit here, grammar. Oh my goodness, if you have not looked at an English curriculum lately, take a gander at the lack of grammar. It is completely absent, almost completely absent from the curriculum these days. They still do, I guess, periods and capital letters. But even seniors, even like, I had in class the AP Physics seniors and the AP Calculus seniors. They don't know the word antecedent. They don't know transitive versus intransitive in most cases. A couple of them do, but they learn that on their own outside of the curriculum, transitive and intransitive. Maybe one class in ninth grade mentions transitive and intransitive, but it certainly isn't reinforced, and it certainly doesn't come up on, for example, the New York state exams. They hardly even know adjective versus adverb without thinking hard about it. They don't know appositives. They don't know two different meanings of apostrophe. They don't know a gerund or a participle. They haven't heard that at all. Phrases and clauses are identical to them. They've heard those terms, certainly, but just they have only a layman's definition of them. They're groups of words. That's all they know, phrases and clauses. Prepositions. Are dimly aware of prepositions. Subject versus object, maybe on a good day because of foreign language class, they know these things, but not quickly, certainly isn't at the tip of their tongue. Spelling, I will say, is vastly improved since the 90s, right? In the 90s, there was that poor, unfortunate generation of students who went through American school system under whole language, right? Whole language was this terrible idea that we didn't need to teach spelling in grade school because kids would naturally learn it. The other teachers would say to me, "Oh, no, you don't have to teach them to spell. Have you ever seen a 20-year-old who doesn't know how to spell walk or a 20-year-old who doesn't know how to spell behave? Of course not. Everybody learns it. You don't need to teach it to it. It's like talking. You never meet an 18-year-old who can't talk. You didn't have to teach kids how to talk. You don't have to teach them how to spell either. Wrong. Buzzing sounds. No. Go back to go. Do not pass or go to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. That was wrong. Thankfully, we corrected that. Unfortunately, we're kind of doing the same thing with math right now. They do teach the kids math facts, but they don't make them practice algebra. Instead, they waste their time doing all kinds of things and think it will carry over to algebra without actually practicing algebra. So I constantly have kids coming into physics and calculus that get an equation like 5 over x equals 2, and they can't solve that for x. Something about x being the denominator, they just haven't practiced it enough. It's frustrating. So the point about grammar is it doesn't even have to be prescriptive or descriptive. Of course, prescriptive grammar tells people what they ought to be doing, how they ought to speak, but descriptive grammar is far less oppressive. It just describes what is out there, and it's still extremely useful, but our curriculum does not even teach descriptive grammar. They do teach semicolons. Kids for the last 10 years are all about the semicolons. But commas? No. Restrictive versus non-restrictive clauses? Not a clue. Too busy perhaps picking out their own pronouns to learn how English traditionally uses pronouns. So yes, grammar's gone by the side of the road, and they just it's all reading comprehension in English class now. It's all reading comprehension, and they look for themes like oppression, like how evil capitalism is. It's very depressing. By the way, my pronouns are I and you. Yeah, not like normal, though. I mean, I use my pronouns that way, too. But referring to me, to use my pronouns correctly in the third person as a subject, it's I, as in Frank went to the store, he got milk. Don't say that. Don't say Frank went to the store, he got milk. My pronouns, it's Frank went to the store, I got milk. That's right, even if you're not me. I've chosen that pronoun. That's my choice. My choice. And then if it's third person and it's the object, my pronoun is you, not she, her, he, him, I, you. So third person object, you. Don't say Frank stood under the bucket at the water park. Eventually it tipped over and poured water on him. It's actually, please say Frank stood under the bucket at the water park. Eventually it tipped over and poured water on you. Yeah, so see, you can have a lot of fun with grammar. A lot of fun with grammar. There are good reasons to learn grammar. That is going to wrap it up for us today, guys. We went through the 8 topics that high schoolers, teenagers really don't know these days. And again, it's not necessarily their fault. It is the education system failing them, teaching them things that, in my opinion, are far less valuable instead of these things. And of course, we also talked about light and science fact of the day, laser light, and how light bounces around and worms its way through things. Don't forget to go out and pick up a copy of Project Hail Mary. Such a great book. Hey, you can do that later today, and I will see you tomorrow. Take care, folks.